he's right here, so. What are we talking about? He cold topped it.
Okay. Ready to go. Yeah.
Dave Iron.
Oh, we shanked it. Oh, look at that line, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, boy, is he out of sync.
Welcome to the Bogey Boys podcast.
Joined here by Kevin and Mark, and Mr. Matthew Baldwin here took a bit of time out of his schedule of isolation to speak to us.
How's it going, lads?
All right, mate, how are you?
Yeah, not bad. Bit bored, like, but I'm getting there.
I can imagine, yeah, in isolation. Just got home from a couple of weeks in Dubai, I believe.
Yeah, I went out practicing with the intention to go to South Africa for the first three Challenge Tour events, and unfortunately, when I arrived, it was put back to April, so... That was a bit of a bummer, but you know, I got some good work done, which is the reason why I went. So yeah, it was a positive trip.
And while you were out there, obviously you just had the Desert Swing as well. Was there an opportunity, if there was any pullouts, for you to get into those events as well?
No. I mean, listen, at the end of the day, I was there, so anything could have happened. But you, the fields were so strong that there was a load of other lads kind of on standby as well, so to speak.
Yeah.
I played quite a lot of golf with Jack Senior, and he didn't get into any of the three that he would have done last year, which was obviously disappointing for him. But, you know, he'd have got in the field before me. So, yeah, right. There was no chance of that. I mean, you never say never, but no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
when you say they're on standby, are they actually out there, or is the list go? It doesn't matter where you are, you're in the list, even if they have to fly out.
Yeah, I mean, you've got an entry list. Obviously, there's a certain cut-off point, and then, if certainly at the beginning of the year, you want to try and get out to obviously warmer climates anyway. So a lot of the lads were out there practicing. You know, some of the lads even live there now that weren't in the event. So there was quite good, really, because there was quite a lot of us out there practicing kind of together and having games together and stuff. But, when you get like a cut-off entry list, there's always, you're looking at the first kind of five, six reserves will get into the event normally.
Yeah.
There's always five or six pullouts. It's inevitable. There's always going to be people that are entered into the list that don't want to play or can't play because they're injured. But they leave it last minute to pull out because they want to give themselves the best opportunity to play.
Yeah, definitely. So how was the whole thing over in Dubai then? Or did you get out of it what you wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, I practiced hard every day. I went to the gym pretty much every day as well. Played some great golf courses out there. Practiced at Jumeirah Golf Estates and Trump, Dubai. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, what a place for practice. It's unreal. And strangely, it was like normal life. You know, we're at home now in lockdown, can't leave the house. They're like normal life. It's just weird.
It is. It's very strange year, and we can touch on that as well about how the COVID year went on tour for you as well, because you've obviously just come off the back of a decent season as well, haven't you? Back here now. Where are you? 10 days isolation now.
Yeah, I'm in day six, so I've been spending a lot of time on my indoor bike and lifting very little weight that I've got.
Crawling the walls.
What are you doing golf-wise? Obviously, we collared you yesterday when you were putting to get you on the podcast, but what are you doing swing-wise? Like,
nothing.
Nothing?
I mean, I've got some speed sticks that I have had every intention of going into the garden and using, but I have still yet not taken the wrapper off them.
Brilliant. But as we were saying before, the purpose of this podcast is to get like professionals who know what it takes to make it, know what it takes to win out on tour, or even just do a PGA route, any sort of way that they've turned professional, and just get the backstories and give it up to where they are now and then what the plans are for the future. That's basically what we're going to do. So basically for you, where did it all get started with golf, and what was your first handicap, and where did you play your golf growing up?
I played all sports when I was younger. So my granddad, he played rugby for Warrington, Blackpool Borough and Widnes, and he played for England a few times as well. So I've got a bit of a sporting background on that sense. But he used to take me on the local fields when I was like two and three, just swinging a golf club and things like that. But I think it all kind of changed for me with my golf was when I was 14. I won the Lancashire under 18s. I was just 14.
Yeah.
And it was kind of unheard of back then for someone so young to win, you know, an age group thing so much higher. So that kind of propelled me into the England setup, and then it just took over from there, really. I mean, I played for England at 15 to 21. I turned pro off plus three. I was off plus three when I was 16. So yeah, it's always been something that I've done. And you know, did I want to do it as a professional when I was 14? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, but I had the options of playing tennis, played squash. Fortunately for me, I chose the right route. Yeah, I think.
No, definitely. Yeah, when you look back at your career, it's just a fantastic achievement you've had there, mate. Definitely. So talking about the progression there, you mentioned that you played for England. How was that whole setup for you?
I was I got on the England squad when I was 14, and I played my first game when I was 15 for the with, funnily enough, with Paul Waring at the, I think it was England versus Italy. I was saying a thing, I should know this really, shouldn't I? England versus Italy, the under 16th, and it was at a golf course called Radcliffe-on-Trent. That was my first experience of actually playing for England. And then I played the following year in the same match, because I was still technically under 16, even though I was 16. And then that year I played the home internationals under 18. So I had a year off at 17, and then I was England boys captain at 18. So my experiences with England were, as a whole, good. I mean, don't get me wrong, there was times where I was pulling the air out, and you know, I wanted to kind of, I think with most golfers, they want to kind of do their own thing in the long run, because it is an individual sport.
Yeah.
But as a whole, I can't fault it. It was brilliant. I got to travel the world. I got to play for your country. And it was a great stepping stone to turning pro.
Because we've had a couple of other people who've been in the England setup, like Sean Tando, Tom Gandy, and like we've had one speaking positively of it, and then we had Tom speaking like he just wanted to be left alone and like do his own thing, and he actually went backwards.
From my experiences, I sometimes feel like, at least, the coaches were fantastic, but it's an individual sport, and when I think back, sometimes you see a new coach, and that was the thing. You don't always see the same coach when you're, you know, in group training, so to speak.
Yeah.
So each coach has different ideas about where you should be going with your golf swing or your putting or your chipping or your mental game or whatever it may be. And because obviously they were responsible for a lot of kind of kids and young lads kind of developing, I always felt like sometimes they had to say something, whereas actually they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And I felt that. I mean, I was on a great setup with the team Faldo. It was a great thing that we were on. You know, I was with Rory, and I was with Ollie Fisher, and I was with Mel Reid, who's gone on to be a successful girl golfer. There was a great bunch of people. But then, same sort of thing. You were with a coach who's by right a very, very good coach and very successful coach, but just because he had to have an input into your golf, it's sometimes not what you want to hear or not what you need at the time. Whereas, you know, like I said, it is effectively an individual sport. So you choose who you want to coach you and stick with them until it doesn't work any longer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And that's what we found that as well, of having those conversations with previous lads who've been in the England setup. They've gone on to turn professional, and it's sort of then you are officially on your own, and you're going into a brand new pond with a whole new different level of players. Did you find that as well within that transition once you'd finished the England and from turn pro? How difficult did you find the transition?
Oh, it was exciting, but it was difficult. I mean, I went from, you know, I turned pro at 22. I signed with ISM. I was fortunate to sign with Chubby, who got me, I think, I signed in July, just before the Open. I didn't play the Open, but I just remember signing just before the Open. So, and I think I played three Challenge Tour events that year, maybe two or three Euro Pros, and then I made the decision that I was going to go and play on the Alps Tour for the following year, which is effectively the French version of the Euro Pro.
Yeah.
And it was tough. You know, there was no money available, but what it did do was it made you learn to be on the road. Because you were literally, you know, me and a lad called Stevie Luton, who's I think he's on the Corn, well, he is on the Corn Ferry Tour at the moment. We travelled around Europe together in a car, effectively. Like, you know, we hired a car each week. We stayed in pretty average digs and did it kind of things on a budget, but it was a great experience. In fact, it was probably the most fun I had since I've been pro. You know, they always say, don't they? Yeah. School's the best time of your life. Sort of
yeah.
And that was effectively school, but for golf.
So what was the reason to go on over to the Alps, just to try something different because you give it a go on the Euro Pro a couple of times? Because I believe is it top five there get you the Challenge Tour card the same as Euro Pro?
Yeah, is that absolutely exactly the same? Do you know what? I think it was more. I don't think there was as much money to play for, but I think it wasn't as top heavy.
Yeah.
So like, if you finish, like, say, fifth in the Euro Pro back then, I mean, I'm not sure what it's like now, but if you finish, say, fifth in the Euro Pro back then, you weren't picking up much money. If you picked up, you know, fifth money in on the Alps Tour, you could survive almost. You could take away even, you know, a couple hundred quid from the week after your expenses and stuff. So, but that, you know, and I also think as well, back then there was a lot more events. So, you know, it was a lot more of a fuller season.
Do you know when you're on the Alps Tour there and you said you signed with Chubby Chandler, is he helping you fund that then, is he? Or did you have a different...
Yeah, he was. It's a bit, I mean, you know, like with a lot of his guys, he funds them until obviously they, you know, they can pay him back. And he was great like that. Listen, he was brilliant. He didn't have to do that. Everything could have been out of your own pocket, but he, you know, he took a chance on us. And I'd like to think I've kind of paid him back. And
what we're finding is through the speaking that we've done, like 12 or 13 of these anyway, and it's all about money.
Loving your cup there, by the way.
Oh, you were giving me the cup there.
I think that's your cue to shut the fuck up. Brilliant.
Sorry, what were you saying? I was completely distracted then.
I was saying that what we found is with all these people that we've been interviewing, it's all about the money. If they haven't got the funding, then they just can't make it. Like, they get a couple of years off a person at the golf club, or it's just all about funding.
Yeah, I mean... I think you've got to go out and you've got to do it. Do you know what I mean? You've got to do it. You can't rely on someone else to fund you. You've got to go out and you've got to be the one that you know makes the difference. Not the guy who's sponsoring you, unfortunately. And I know it's a bit of a blunt reply to you, but it's a fact. You know, you've got to get to where you want to go as quick as possible.
Yeah. Definitely. And I can see from your progression, it was 2011, your first win on the Challenge Tour, wasn't it? So was that the turning point for you, do you think? Because obviously since then, you've cemented your place in between Challenge and European Tour since that position.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I turned pro in 08. I played a little bit, and then I played a little bit that year, and then I played a lot 09. Chubby got me 4 invites, and I got myself another 4 invites to the Challenge Tour for 10.
Yeah.
Which then got me... effectively a full card for the Challenge Tour for 11. And then I started, funny enough, going back to Chubby, I always remember him calling me pretty much the week before I was due to go to India for the first Challenge Tour event of the year in 2011. And he said, look, he said, you've got 400 quid left. I can't give you any more money. So, I didn't know what I was going to do after that. So I went to India with 400 quid left. And I don't know whether it spurred me on or, you know, or give me a bit of a kick up the arse or whatever it was. But I finished fourth that week and I picked up 12,000 quid for it. So that then spurred me on to then go and I went to Colombia from there and I finished sixth, I think, and I picked up another, say, like 8,000. I can't remember the exact figures, but it was about 8,000. And that paid for me a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll never know whether Chubby would have given me any more money or not. But at that point, it was a bit of pressure for me, to go out and I guess it did spur me on looking back, and I won towards the back end of the year, and I had a bit of a blip in the middle after Colombia. I missed 4 out of the next 6 cuts, and then finished in the other two like 50 or 60th or something, which is picking up, you know, even on the Challenge, it's picking up 300 quid, which is better than nothing, but it's good for nothing at the same time. So then I had a run. I started working with Lee Crumbler, I think, that year, at the beginning of the year. And I had a run of 11 events where I won the 11th event and I finished 3rd in the 10th event. But I wasn't outside the top 20 in them 11 events. So I was picking up money consistently. And then all of a sudden, the 3rd in the win, jumped me up to 10th in the rankings, which is where I finished.
That's nice. Do you think that was a tactical move by Chubby, or like, how does the conversation go when he says you've got 400 quid? What do you say? Like, why? Or like, just say fine, or what do you do?
Yeah, to be honest, it was 10 years ago. To try and recall what the exact conversation was would be quite difficult. But yeah, it was, I don't know, it might have been a tactical move. Listen, he might support me for the rest of the year, even if I missed the first five cuts. I don't know, but might have been a clever bit of management.
I'm just wondering, has he ever said, like, I've done that on purpose there to spur you on, or did I just forget about?
Yeah, we've never had the conversation since. I mean, I'm not with ISM anymore. I'm with Octagon, who Stuart Cage was at ISM, and I moved over to Octagon with Stu.
Yeah. Right. So moving on to, obviously, throughout the years, then 2011, you said your first win there, and then you started playing in the major championships from 2012. Obviously, one was the Open at Royal Lytham. What was that whole experience like, and how did you actually qualify for that?
I got in through Sunningdale, which is the European Tour, like, qualifier for it, which sadly doesn't exist now, but... yeah, what an experience. And obviously never played it. I missed that a couple of times as an amateur by one, but to play kind of, not your home Open, because obviously I'm a member at Royal Birkdale, but to play a very local Open was incredible, really. And to do well in it was, obviously incredible as well.
I see.
I got in through Sunningdale. I remember I said to my Caddy Smarty at the time, I'll never forget this, I was going down the last and I said, I need a birdie to shoot 29 here on the back nine on the Sunningdale New, which at the time Crumble, my sports psychologist, probably would have hit the roof for me, because I'm meant to be process and not outcome stuff. So, but where I recovered it was, I parred it and I still shot 29, so I was that much in the process that I'd forgotten about what score it was.
Brilliant.
So I got in, I think I finished like third, and I think it was like 10 spots. And yeah, so I got in with through Sunningdale, and then I went on to do well in the Open. I finished 23rd. I played a couple of practice rounds with Westy, and as a rookie and a first year out on tour, it was just what an experience.
What you go, it's what you live, dream of, isn't it, really? Getting out there playing the Open and stuff.
I played the US Open about 4 weeks before.
I can see that. Yeah, the Olympic Club, wasn't it?
Yeah, which that was phenomenal as well. That was just mental, really. It's the only way that I can describe it. Mental I played two groups. I think it was either in front or two groups behind Tiger in the first 2 days.
Wow.
And it was absolute chaos.
The crowds, yeah.
Yeah. Being a young kind of rookie, I had like nerves of steel. I didn't care. I was loving it. I thrived on it.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'd be like, shit.
Yeah, what's over here? Yeah.
Yeah. Can't take it back. My legs are like jelly.
You know, with the US Open courses are known for like difficult, like being a difficult test. Does being a member of Birkdale have helped you when you went to there, when you went to the Olympic Club?
It was very different golf. I think Birkdale, you've got to realise with Lynx golf courses, they're obviously very weather dependent. If the weather's bad, they are naturally tough courses.
Yeah.
Whereas, obviously, Olympic Club and Oakmont, the other one that I played, they were set up tough. They were made brutally hard just through stupid things like a 110-yard par three, which you couldn't hit a lob wedge to 30 foot because of the pin was at like 2 yards on or 3 yards on the green at the front edge, and it's like trying to land it on a car park.
Oh,
just little things like that, which they intend to do because they want to play with your mind.
Yeah,
you get onto a 110-yard hole, you're thinking, oh, a bit of a chance here, but actually, par's a good score again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, sounds it. So if you could do like a comparison between the two, because see, you've played three Opens and you've played two US Opens. You've just touched on the difficulty and the difference there. What is the actual difference between the two? If you could just talk us through that, a bit of insight.
The US Open, the two that I played were very green, very lush fairways, deep rough. But then the greens were outrageously quick, outrageously slopey and firm. So it's like, you're trying to land your ball in probably 2 or 3 yard kind of areas each time to be able to have a decent putt at a birdie. And like I said, they set it up so that they play with your mind and you lose your rag. And effectively, that, you know, you look at the lads that win it generally are the most patient during that week.
Yeah, so that was about the patience, yeah. And then in the Open, obviously you're used to Lynx golf, aren't you? So
yeah. And the Opens, you know, they're a little bit fast and furious, don't they? They love it playing quick and you know, relying on obviously a bit of bad weather to come in and stuff like that. But I mean, in terms of golf course setups, I mean, I played obviously Lytham, it's tight, big bunkers. It wasn't particularly fast. Got away with the weather a little bit, I think. I think on Friday it was really wet, which obviously then slowed the course up a little bit as well. But I think as a whole, it was quite mild, the weather. And then I played 14 at Hoylake. That was fast. And that was windy as well, to be fair. When I played, I always remember, I played my second round. I think it was about 4 o'clock or something. It was like last out. And Garcia had hauled like a 9-iron on the second in the morning. I hit 4-iron in there. And there was absolutely no way I could have landed it where Garcia landed his 9-iron to hole it, because it was just over a bunker. Wow. You know, so it's very, like I said, it's very draw dependent, very weather dependent.
Definitely, but, yeah. It's a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but you know, if I could play one major for the rest of my life, it'd be the Open. It's phenomenal, you know.
Yeah.
Being British, playing on British golf courses, and that—it's just, yeah, it's incredible.
And I imagine from your perspective as well, you've played Lytham and you've played Royal Liverpool, so I imagine you had a lot of support with you there as well.
I did, yeah. I had a load of family and friends, which is obviously always nice. I mean, I played at Portrush. I had a load of family come over as well, and a couple of friends come over as well. So I think, you know, wherever I play the Open, they'll come to it, but. People that you wouldn't expect to see there, you know, members of the golf club, or they turned up. Members of my old golf course, Hesketh, they came round, and just people that you hadn't seen in a while. And it was really nice. It was, you know, quite overwhelming at times as well. But once you're kind of on the golf course, kind of focused on what you shouldn't be doing, sometimes crowds help because they kind of line the fairways a little bit better for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Matt, going back to your the two US Opens that you've played in, like obviously you do qualifying for the British and different things. How did you get into the US Open? Did you do the same route or
same way? Yeah, the European Tour hold a kind of European qualifier. I think there's 11 spots, and they have that at Walton Heath. And I had 36 holes in one day, and first 11 go through.
Wow, and they say they don't have that no more, no.
They have the US Open one. They didn't last year, obviously, because of COVID, but they have the US Open one. The Open one, they've gone to basically top three players that aren't already exempt in the top 10 at certain events.
Okay.
So, like, I think the Irish Open's one, Scottish Open's definitely one.
Yeah.
Joburg Open, maybe one. So there's certain tournaments around the world, I think probably to give the internationals a bit more of a chance to get in, really.
Yeah, no, but that what you just said, didn't know about that, the Walton Heath one there, it's good that you can just turn up on a good day, 36 holes, and next thing you play in the US Open, yeah?
Top 500 in the world ranking to be able to get in.
Yeah, right.
Say, Kev, I think Kev was getting some ideas.
Get practicing, Kev.
Yeah, but so obviously that them two finishes in 2012. It was 2012, but one of your biggest years, was it? Because you've made the cut in both the majors. And what happened for the rest of that year?
It was my rookie year, so everything I was doing again was really exciting. It was really new, and you know, like I said, there was times where it was tough, as there is every year. But it was everything was like a challenge for me. See how good I could be. See how good I am, sort of thing. Whereas I think, you know, it slightly changes over the years where you know, moving forward sort of thing. You shouldn't do, but, it, you know, effectively does, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course, yeah. So before we move on to 13 and 14 there, we see from there your biggest years, especially financially, and your best finishes. The idea of these podcasts is to provide some insights to the next generation coming through. Because it was your transition there is 4 years of playing in and around the Euro Pro, the Alps Tour, then on to Challenge, winning on Challenge, then playing in the Open rookie year on the European Tour. Then you've went to cement yourself on the European Tour 13 and 14. So just building on your experiences for those first couple of years as a professional, what insight you could give to the next generation coming through as to what they're best doing?
Test themselves as much as possible.
Yeah.
I know it's obviously a bit of a short answer, but it's play with as many good golfers as you can. See if you can beat them on a consistent basis. Have a good team behind you. I know it's a simple answer, but have a coach that you trust. See him as much as you can. Get as much advice off him as you can. Yeah, just explore your talent, really. See what you can do. Just hit it. I mean, hit it as hard as you can. Find it. Hit it again.
Yeah, brilliant.
And then all the putt.
That's what we do, but we struggle to find it, don't we, Kev, after we hit the razor?
So do I.
Then he took that extra 2 minutes off looking for the ball. We've fucking never had a worse score since. But that's good advice, though, isn't it? Because as every golfer knows, when you play with a better player, you end up having the round of your life, and it's no coincidence that they raise your standard.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know what I mean? See, I guess as well, when you're a young lad or a young pro and stuff. Even if you're just going out for a round of golf and you get the opportunity to play with someone who is effectively miles better than you, it's going to make you nervous.
Yeah.
So you're going to see how you react to the situation, aren't you?
Yeah.
And even if you don't react well to it, you can learn from it.
Definitely.
Yeah. No, brilliant insight to me, yeah. So I'd say moving on to 13 and 14, I've just touched on that, the biggest years that you've had. Was that just you learn from your experiences in 12? So just talk us through 13 and 14 and what your game, where your game was.
I think so. I mean, 13 was 30. I always remember 13 being quite a frustrating year, to be honest, because I kind of had it in my head that it was a bit like, you know, second season syndrome in the Premier League, where you've got a team that stays up and they stay up for 1 year and then they go down the second year.
Yeah.
I always remember kind of having that sort of attitude. And I know that's obviously not a great attitude to have, but it was almost like, come on, make the cut. Come on, get enough money to get your card up. And every week, I made the cut. I had a pretty consistent year with that. But I never, looking back, I don't think I ever really had any great finishes.
No.
I think I might have finished fifth in Morocco.
Two top tens you had, yeah, in that year?
Yeah. And I mean, I can't remember where they were, to be fair.
Yeah.
but I always kind of remember having that sort of don't mess this up sort of attitude rather than actually, where can we go now?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I always remember working with a guy called Stuart Foams, and he always used to say, look, when you get on the European Tour, you've got to work your arse off to stand still. And it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, you know, 2013 was a frustrating year on that front because I did effectively work my arse off to stay still. So, you know, I think I finished similar to what I finished in 2012, but I didn't have the same kind of experiences that I had in 2012 as I did in 13. It was just a lot more kind of consistent, a lot more steady and, you know, effectively a bit more boring almost.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say about second season. It's like, obviously, if a team went and won the Premier League and then the next season they're struggling to make top four, it's sort of like that, isn't it?
Brilliant. Yeah, shut the fuck up.
I want to shut the fuck up again.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Making the worst title defence in Premier League history, apparently. Like, yeah, cheers.
We won't disagree with that.
Yeah, but to be fair, though, we're not allowed to talk about injuries because, you know, it's just excuses, isn't it?
Yeah. No, that's it. That's
no, I just feel like, because obviously for the listeners, Matthew's a Liverpool fan and we're an Everton fan, so we're just having a bit of banter.
Yeah.
Where are you in the league?
Sixth, I think. Oh, you're
still good. Behind us then.
It's good for us, though.
Still behind us.
We'll take that. We're on the way up, not the way down. That's the good thing.
Oh, right, okay. You've been saying that since 1995.
And the rest. Brilliant. Yeah, back onto the golf then. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 14 then, big year for you.
Yeah, it was. It was a good year. I started the year off, I think, with a second place in South Africa, which could have won. You know, had opportunities to win. Didn't shy away from it. I just honestly got beat by the better golfer on the day.
Yeah.
You know, I won't go into who it was or or anything like that. Could be quite controversial, my comments, but
yeah. We live for controversy, get the
better. we'll leave it there, we'll go no further.
Okay.
But yeah, so that kind of spearheaded my year. Had a bit of a funny year in terms of consistency. I think I only made half the cuts, but it seemed to the cuts that I did make, I was always kind of there or thereabouts to have a really good finish. You know, and it going into the middle of the year, I finished third in the Irish Open, which got me into the Open. I had a great opportunity to win that. I birdied the last to finish third. I bogeyed 17, unfortunately, but I birdied the last to finish third. And then the following week, it's just kind of, I'm not going to turn around and say through complacency, but just kind of almost expecting to do well, miss the cut. So it's a bit like, you know, two steps forward, one step back. I know it's obviously usually one step forward, two steps back, but that was a bit of a kick in the bollocks sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which arguably got me on my game again. And then the week after that, I finished fifth in the French Open, which was a massive tournament back then. I mean, I know it's not quite as big now, but it was a massive tournament back then. And you know, I had two out of three really good weeks and then went into the Scottish Open and the Open and played absolute crap at the Open. I mean, I don't know whether I put a bit too much pressure on myself to do well because I was knew I was doing well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I just played crap. And then I had a bit of a break after that. I had a holiday and bit of time off and then came back and wasn't really the same, but I managed to just kind of get into the top 60 and played DP World, and yeah, it was a great year.
Yeah, so you were saying that you piled pressure on yourself at the Open. I know you were saying it's good having home support, but does the fact that it was at Royal Liverpool and you had pressure onto yourself, is that what you sort of were getting at?
No, I don't think so. I think it was more just me. More, listen, at the end of the day, there's only one person who can put pressure on yourself, and it's yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what some of the famous cliche signs, sayings in the world, there is no pressure. Yeah. Pressure's for tyres and things like that. But
yeah,
there is pressure when you put it on yourself. You can't physically put pressure on me. Yeah? The only person that can do it is myself.
Of course.
And yeah. I think I kind of went into it expecting kind of good things and expecting to do well, and yeah, it didn't work out.
Yeah. Okay, and then we see obviously the following year. Then in 15, you took some time off. What happened there with 15? Because I think when you played, was it five or six tournaments? Was it?
Yeah, I think I started the year off pretty steady, a lot of cuts, but nothing going. And then I went to China and unfortunately fell ill. I had 3 days in bed and then flew home, and I had to take the rest of the year off. Really, I played one more tournament after China, which was Wentworth. Which I kind of had permission off the tour to do, even though they knew I was going to kind of stop playing, but because I was in the UK, they knew I could get medical advice if I needed it. And it turns out that I ended up in hospital on the Friday night. So,
did you?
So that wasn't clever. But yeah, the rest of the year, I'd take time off to get well again and try and come back fit for 16, which. I did do that physically, but mentally probably wasn't prepared for it.
Yeah, and was it so for 15 when you took the time off, was it just no golf at all? Did you take clubs away?
Literally no golf.
Wow.
Couldn't do it for insurance reasons, really. I had a, you know, an insurance policy in place that said, like, look, as soon as you start playing golf again, you know, we'll stop paying you, to cover my cost of living.
Yeah.
Wow. There were spells during kind of the operations that I had where I had 4 months off. I was completely physically fit, but knowing that I had to go through another operation to kind of complete the process, there wasn't any point.
Yeah.
To kind of use that time actually to kind of lose a bit of weight, get fit and get healthy.
Yeah. It's pretty inspirational to see then how you've took that whole year off there, no golf, no nothing, to come back the way you have over 16 up to now, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm nowhere near where I want to be. Absolutely nowhere near where I want to be. I want to be better than where I was in 14. It's taking me a hell of a long time to get back there. I do believe I will.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fitter and stronger than I've ever been, and I'm playing better golf than I've ever been. Unfortunately, I'm playing better golf than I've ever played on the wrong tour. You know, if I played like I did kind of towards the back end of last year on the main tour, I would be nearly halfway there. Do you know what I mean? So it's been a very tough kind of 5 years from that point, if I'm honest. It's been there's been times where I've wondered why I'm bothering. There's also been times where, you know, I've kind of been feeling like I'm getting somewhere, and then all of a sudden something happens, myself, or things out of my control, sort of thing, where, you know, I've not been able to get back to where I was. I mean, I got my car, I played 2016, and I played, I think my third event back was Abu Dhabi, and I was surprisingly third going into the last round. Real surprise. I was 10 under, second to last group out with Ben Ann and Gracie. And it was out of nowhere. Like, you know, I had a crap Sunday. I think I shot 75 and finished like 20th. Yeah. But thinking that I would go push on from there, I didn't. I almost used that crap last round, sort of, so to speak, as a bit of a negative for the rest of the year. And I went on and missed like 17 cuts on the run. And then it was only after the time that I kind of accepted that I was going to lose my card that I started to play a little bit better again. Frustrating, but yeah. Arguably I came back too quickly. Not, again, you know, touched on it earlier, not physically, but mentally I came back too quickly. I have no kind of... Initially, I was chomping at the bit. I wanted to get back as soon as I could. And I always remember having a phone call conversation with David Garland, who's, I'm not exactly sure on his full title of the tour, but he's, you know, he's very high up on the tour. And he said, look, the only advice I'm going to give you is don't rush back. But I did a rush back because I was dying to play.
Yeah.
But it soon became apparent that I wasn't ready. And it was too late by then because I played 10 events and declared that I was fit to play. So I had to kind of carry on.
Crack on with it, yeah.
Yeah.
As you say, having a year off not doing anything is hard, isn't it, to get back. So it's going to put you back. But seems to, like, obviously as your momentum's going now, it's hopefully that's all behind you, just a year to forget.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, like I said, certainly towards the back end, the last kind of 3 months of, or two, 3 months of last season, I started to show form again, started to kind of believe in my form again. So hopefully, if we get to play golf this year, I'll say if.
Yeah.
Hopefully I can show it, but
yeah,
it's down to me, isn't it? So,
it is. Even looking at your results there from last year, was it tied second in Andalusia, wasn't it? You just missed out by a shot there from winning that on the Challenge Tour, and then you've played a number of European Tour events last year in the English swing, didn't you? So I was the whole COVID saga of last year. How did you find that?
Well, I started off well in January. Started off well, played South African Open, finished 20th or something like that, can't remember. And then I went to South Africa, missed the first cut, but then played really solid for the next 2 weeks. And then COVID hit. So then we had three months off, I think it was. Three months off without a tournament. And I came back from, you know, the break almost. I kind of made it my mission that I was going to lose quite a lot of weight, and I got fit and I lost 2 stone and looked really well and that, but it was absolutely useless for my golf.
Was it?
That was useless. Okay, I came back and I was fit, but I just couldn't find the balance of kind of swinging the golf club and being fit. Do you know what I mean? I almost had to grow into it again, sort of thing now. And after the first 6-7 tournaments, I think I made one cut, and even in that one cut, I would finish like dead last. But you know, over that time, I sort of build up a bit of strength, almost a bit match fit, like, so to speak. And then, you know, towards the back end of the year, I was, like I said, a bit more match fit, and I started playing a bit better golf again.
Yeah.
Do when you say you find the balance, do you mean as in like your physical, or do you mean like when to practice and when to run and when to lift weights?
No, I think more the physical side of it. I think I mean, you hear about it quite a lot, really. You hear about lads that kind of lose a lot of weight and get a lot fitter, but then they can't swing a golf club because they're not used to it, because it's not their body type, sort of thing. Do you know what I mean?
So whereas, yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
Darren Clark. Something like that happened to Darren Clark, where he couldn't swing.
It happened to Clark. I think it happened to Monty. Yeah. I mean, there's always also on the other side of it, there's been loads of positive lads, positive things that have done it. Yeah. So, you know, look at like Rory, for example. Rory's always a chubby kid, wasn't he? You know, look back, first few years out on tour, he was a chubby kid.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden now he's like this absolute machine, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he, you know, he's...
Yeah, not a pick on him, yeah.
There you go.
No.
Horses is isn't it?
Well, it's similar. Exactly. What we talk about machines there as well. You've got Bryson, the whole Bryson saga, and what's going on there. What's your whole opinion on what he's doing and the distance he's going for and trying to dominate courses? Are you one of them? I know you mentioned there you got some swing sticks ordered. Are you working on your swing speed and things?
I think everyone can work on the swing speed. You know, Bryson swings at 130 mile an hour. It gets to 215 mile an hour, whatever his ball speed. He wants to get to 220. Everyone always wants to hit it further. I think he's very inspirational in what he's done. Is it for me? No. You know, I look at, say, DJ, who is out and out the best golfer in the world, and he is naturally an athlete, but everything he does is in balance. He hits it 330 yards through the air. Same with Rory. Everything he does is in balance. When you watch Bryson do it, and granted, he's going to have his weeks where he absolutely tears the golf course apart because he's going to hit it straight. But it doesn't look to me like it's balanced. So he's going to have, and I think he's even said it himself, he's going to have weeks where he's not going to compete because he's going to wang it everywhere.
Yeah.
But he's going to have the weeks, certain weeks of the year, and if he tailors it to him where he peaks at the right time, he's going to win what he wants to win, which is the majors.
I thought you were going to give an answer then by saying, well, the fact I haven't took my speed sticks out the wrapper surely give you an indication of where I'm at with that.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. After this conversation, I'm going straight in the garden.
There you go. Bit of inspiration. Lovely stuff. So what's next then for you, Matt? What's the plans? I know you've got your isolation now, and then you've got what challenge, full challenge tour card next year.
I've got a full challenge, and then it's not a very nice way of putting it, but I feel like I'm in a little bit of no man's land with it, because I've got a full challenge. But I've got some sort of status on the European Tour, which last year got me into kind of 90%, 95% of the tournaments after the restart. Whereas this year, I'll be surprised if I get in, say, 10% of them, because they are doing, they've announced, unless obviously it changes again, they've announced that they're going to do promotion onto the tour and relegation off the tour. New boys know about that, with the relegation, wouldn't you? Every year.
Here he is.
So I can't see people not playing this year, which will mean that, you know, through the tournaments on the European Tour, the strength and depth will be there. So I won't, unfortunately, I don't think I'll get the call up. I think even if I did, I'd probably still play on the Challenge Tour, because my target is to get off it and get back to where I want to be. That's meant to be starting in April. We'll see. It's meant to be starting in Africa. I'd love to go. I'd love to go and compete, but I just can't at the moment see it happening.
Yeah.
And then from May onwards, it's Europe. And there's about, I think there's 25 on the schedule. That's including the three in South Africa, including two in China. So say there's 20 events in Europe, which is more than enough to determine who the best 15, 20 golfers are on the tour that year.
Yeah.
Definitely. Do you know what, Matt, when you come second in Spain, and obviously you've won in Spain, you know, when you're actually going to go to Spain, are you feeling like more positive and like better when you're going there, like mentally? Or is that just a coincidence?
I think it's probably just a coincidence, really. I mean,
because some people, like, you know, you play well at it, football players play well at a certain ground or a certain course. Just
never really thought of it like that, to be fair. I've won other tournaments in Spain as well, First time I've really kind of thought about it. I finished...
On the plane to Spain, right? Give us a call and let me know how you're feeling.
Yeah, I will. Took a tenner on me. I think one of the first events is in Spain, actually. So
well, there we go. You're getting backed.
To be fair, I never really thought about that. I think... I'm trying to think whether the golf courses were similar. The golf courses were quite similar, actually, yeah?
Yeah.
So maybe it was more the golf courses than the actual...
They suited your game, yeah.
So. And one more little question here. If you weren't a golfer, what do you reckon you'd be doing?
Binman? Pass.
No idea.
I've got no idea.
No.
You know what's really funny is that I was saying this to my mum the other day and my missus. I said, I've always played golf. So, like, I've never thought about what I would do if I had to stop playing golf. And only in recent kind of, you know, the pandemic and where I'm at with my career and stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm 34 and, you know, I'm not no spring chicken anymore. I'm still young in terms of, the lads that are doing well and out on tour. Yeah. But I'm not on tour. So to get back on tour, I'm going to be one of the older boys when I get back there. And I've always kind of thought, what would I do? And I am absolutely clueless.
Have you got any
recommendations? Like, let me know.
Come and join our podcast with us.
All right, yeah. You become one of the bogey boys.
Yeah. Might have to change it to Beardy Boys then, if you're joining us.
Yeah. can't be associated with bogeys.
No, definitely not.
That's because we're shite.
Yeah, definitely.
When did you start working with Lee Crumbling? Because we've had him on and we've had a good insight into his philosophy and all that.
I reckon I've worked with Crumbling on and off, more on than off, but on and off for 14, 15 years.
All right, nice.
Yeah, even probably just before as an amp, just before I turned pro, I was working with him.
Yeah.
Great bloke. One of me. You know, not just a sports psychologist to me now, he's a really good friend and
top lad in here.
Massively trust, yeah.
And do you think that's important, again, going back to the insights and things for people who are making that transition to pro, about getting a strong team behind you from the very start? So would you say that get a psychologist straight away, golf coach, but not just a swing coach, the different elements you put in the short game?
I would say that's probably one of the most important things you can do is get a group of people behind you that you know you trust and lean on them. Use their experiences, use their knowledge. Get as much info as you can. I mean, I'm preaching here a little bit. I probably should practice it a bit more. But like, you know, there's guys out there with unbelievable knowledge that want to help people. Yeah. So why not use them?
Use that to your advantage. Yeah. Just gonna say, just before, obviously, just a couple of little fun questions more than anything. So, who's the best player you've ever played with, Matt?
Best player I've ever played with, who is the best player now, is Rory. But he was a young kid when I was. Used to play a lot of golf with him. Best player I played with since I turned pro, it's got to be Westwood.
Yeah, Westy.
Yeah, Thomas Peters as well. He was something else when I played with him.
Was he? Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing to see what Westwood's still doing now. It is, as you mentioned there, about being 34, but he's, what is he now, 47,
I think he is.
47, 48, yeah. So, like you say, and he's still winning the top events as well, isn't he?
Yeah. I played with Westwood in 2012. I played with him two or three times and I always remember, like, just practice rounds with him. I played around the Olympic Club, and all day he was 10, 15 past me. You know, I'm not short. I'm not long. I'm about average, maybe a tad longer than average. So, he 10, 15 past me. And all of a sudden, on 16, he's hit one, like, 40 yards past me. And I'm like, where has that come from? And he's like, well, you've got to have it in the tank, haven't you?
just saving it.
Yeah. But, unreal. I mean, Teter Green, the best you'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very, very consistent, isn't he?
Shows, doesn't he, as well?
Definitely shows, yeah. And then just another one, of a couple here, the best tournament you've played in and the best course you've ever played on.
Yeah, best experiences, I'll say, the US Open.
Okay. Yeah.
Best experiences, US Open. Best tournaments, the Open. Just because it's the Open, and I'm English.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously, having my friends and my family so close, you know, supporting me as well. That's another reason. Best golf course. Get asked this a lot. PGA National or whatever it's called in France is Le National, I think it's called. Phenomenal.
Where they had the Ryder Cup, yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal. Practiced at a golf course in West Palm Beach called Old Palm, which was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Literally not a blade of grass out of place. You know, 18-hole golf course, world-class, every single hole world-class. there was a 19th hole, which was a 110-yard par three over water, which was only used if you drew your match after 18.
Wow.
They had three practice holes around the driving range, a par three, a par four, and a par five, which were all in as good a condition as the golf course. Yeah. And you could go out with a basket of balls and just hit as many balls as you wanted. So that place was...
More places should have that, really, shouldn't they? It's such a good thing. Like, I know Formby Orchard tried to make that little chipping area, didn't he? And, like, obviously failed, but a few little practice holes would be unbelievable. And if you got the space...
It's the money, though. It's the maintenance. Yeah, it's so much money.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't see past Birkdale.
Yeah. What a place.
People are very biased, but if you look at individual holes on Birkdale and then put them all together to make a combined 18, it's brilliant.
Yeah,
so
amazing.
The natural land that it's on, it's just brilliant.
Yeah. No, I love playing Birkdale. I played there a few times myself, yeah.
We have to come over. Yeah, I'll have to get you out there.
Yeah, get us over, yeah.
I'll take you up on that one, not a bother.
Yeah, well, that sounds good.
To chop it around that place.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I'll know why you called the bogey boys then, won't I?
Yeah, you might...
As we said before, I might raise my game and start making birdies when I play with you.
That's it.
How many shots am I getting?
Speaking of bogey boys, we've got a golf day coming up. We've asked every professional that's come on to play and make up the a few teams and stuff. We don't know when it's going to be, but we're going to work it around the schedules of the tours. So hopefully, if you're fancy playing, the invite's there.
If you're free,
no,
Tony.
Yeah, sounds good to me. I'll if I'm home, if it works out, then sounds good to me.
Legend, Matt. Yeah, no, and look, appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. You know, the story's amazing. We wish you the best of luck for this year and for future years going forward. And we wish you luck. We don't wish your football team luck. That's one thing.
I'm not even going to wish you luck now for that.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
Cheers, lads.
Well, thanks a lot. See you later.
Thanks a lot for take. Cheers, mate. That. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, oh boy, is he out of sync.